today, inside Donald Trump's Facebook re-election campaign, and the impact of the death of TV presenter Caroline Flack.
On any given day, the Trump campaign will probably start running anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 new ads.
I am asking you to choose greatness.
Throughout 2019, The Guardian's US technology reporter, Julia Carey Wong, has been investigating how the Trump campaign is using Facebook to target voters.
When I log in and start scrolling, I mean, it's just overwhelming.
Believe me, we're just getting started.
Even if you were to scroll to the end of the new ones on a single day, you just know that the next day there's going to be 2,000 to 6,000 more.
Fact, Donald Trump won, but Democrats want to overturn the election. Don't let them.
She spent a year analyzing how $20 million of Facebook advertising is helping the Trump team understand what makes their supporters tick and what will encourage them to donate to the campaign.
When you start to immerse yourself in this world, it's a different space. And within that space, you know, you start to see the logic of Trump.
And their media lapdogs fall in line. They lost the election. Now they want to steal this one.
And that can be very, very frightening.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, will Facebook be the key to getting Trump re-elected? What was the role of Facebook in the 2016 election?
When Donald Trump won the nomination in 2016, he had very little of what you might term kind of a political campaign operation. He had not had organizers in states, you know, and cities around the country that were going out and knocking on doors and talking to people. What he had, you know, he had this incredible kind of media monopoly as far as everything that he said was massively repeated. And then he had this great popularity that was taking place on social media. And so he brought in a campaign, kind of a digital campaigner who started working aggressively on Facebook.
We're going to make America great again. I love you all.
The red hat and the phrase, make America great again. I mean, he launched his campaign kind of as a meme. Those are shareable, emotive snippets that become things that people react to and want to react to and then share their reaction and get other people to react to. So the whole kind of Donald Trump 2016 experience was really primed for the world of Facebook. And, you know, we don't really know exactly how much of the Facebook campaign mattered, but we do know that once he had his campaign up and running, he invested a huge amount of money in Facebook advertisements, and he really dominated that area.
So he tapped into the idea that Facebook could be a great replacement for on-the-ground campaigning. But that had been something that had been established by candidates in the past with Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, Obama in 2012 had definitely used Facebook quite a bit. You know, so that's the thing. I mean, it's not like he was unique in using Facebook. I mean, Trump's message from, you know, and especially on social media has really dug into the dynamics of social media that reward divisiveness, anger, exclusion, us, them thinking. I mean, these are all things that really thrive in an algorithmic ecosphere where the things that are driving the most emotion are the things that you're seeing more and more.
So whether it's hope or hate, it's a language of extremes that does really well on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if a politician is urging you to be, you know, think and be thoughtful and kind of sit back and consider your options, that is not a response that Facebook is going to say, ooh, we want more people that are not clicking and because they're just sitting there and thinking. What Facebook will respond to is, ooh, you immediately smashed that angry face button. And Facebook takes that as a signal that something good, even though that's not necessarily something that I think objectively we should view as good.
And where was Hillary Clinton in all this? What was her Facebook campaign?
So Hillary Clinton's Facebook campaign was much smaller. She was doing the things that people always say that you should do.
It's a simple but powerful idea. We believe that we are stronger together.
And kind of crucially, Facebook itself was offering two campaigns in 2016. They said to the campaigns, we will send you a team of our engineers and embed them with you and let them show you how to use our ads and, you know, train you on how to do this.
Facebook actively worked with both Democratic and Republican campaigns.
The Trump campaign said, absolutely, come on in. We don't know what we're doing. You show us. The Hillary Clinton campaign said, actually, we're fine. We're quite competent. And they declined the assistance.
I'm Hillary Clinton. And one last time, I approve this message.
That's so interesting that Hillary's campaign just rejected that help. I mean, did Hillary think she was better at doing the memes?
You know, hindsight is 20/20 on this point.
It definitely is. It definitely is. So Trump's campaign says to Facebook, yeah, absolutely, you can come in and work with us. Who specifically went from Facebook to work with the Trump team?
So there was one particular engineer, a man named James Barnes, who was their embedded staffer. And he was a lifelong Republican, and he was helping to really fine-tune some of the very complicated tools that Facebook has for advertisers. He was helping them to figure out, you know, if you have a list of voters that have showed up to your rallies, you can actually upload that into Facebook from your end. And then Facebook will go ahead and match those people that showed up at your rallies. They will find their personal Facebook pages and help you to send them an ad.
Wow.
That is incredibly powerful, you know, to take a real life activity and somebody's name or email address and find them on Facebook and then shoot them a specific ad.
That's scary. That's so specific.
It's incredibly specific. You can also buy all the marketing data and say, well, I also want everybody that subscribes to Field and River, you know, and start to get really personal about people's consumer choices. And then plug that into Facebook, and Facebook kind of does its wizardry and says, all right, now I have, you know, 1,000 people that live in rural Wisconsin that subscribe to a hunting magazine and that voted Republican in the last two elections, but voted for Obama last time around. And I'm going to send them a specific ad that nobody else will ever see.
Are Facebook providing people to work on the Trump campaign this time?
No. I think that they have, just based on the amount of media scrutiny, I think that they have decided to stop doing that.
But is James Barnes, who worked on it before, is he back there again?
No. So James Barnes actually had kind of an interesting journey. He had been kind of a lifelong Republican and I think had, you know, felt perfectly fine doing his job to help Donald Trump get elected. But last year, he actually left Facebook and went to work for a Democratic nonprofit that is aiming to use digital ad campaign strategies to get Trump out of office in 2020.
So working for Trump convinced him to work for the Democrats this time around.
Yeah.
But who has stuck around to work for Trump on his Facebook campaign?
In 2016, the Trump digital campaign was run by this guy named Brad Parscale.
In having that data right there, we can start to see where persuadable targets are. The data doesn't lie. And that's the beauty about data.
A kind of Texas-based digital marketing guy. He famously kind of first came into contact with the Trump family just by building a website for them and ended up running the digital campaign, which I think in 2016 largely meant letting Facebook run the digital campaign for them. He was elevated to be the overall campaign manager for Trump's reelection campaign. So he's now running the whole show.
Well, hello, New Hampshire.
He appears quite often at Trump's rallies. He has become kind of a fan favorite. He's kind of this giant 6'8" man with a large Viking beard, so he's very striking looking.
But we're going to do it right in 2020. We're going to make.
He talks a very big game about the sophistication of the Facebook ad and how much they're doing, you know. And they talk about their campaign headquarters as kind of being the Death Star. Most of the report, a lot of the reporting on what was so smart that they did in 2016. Was just to let other smarter people run it for them. And they're certainly, I think, using it effectively to raise money.
Julia, you've been analysing Trump's Facebook adverts for the past year. What seems to be different about his Facebook campaign this time around?
I mean, the main thing that is different this time around is that we're able to actually see it. And that's just completely different than what happened in 2016. You know, in 2016, we were entirely reliant on, you know, individual citizens maybe seeing an ad and screenshotting it. But we honestly just don't know everything about what he was doing. This time around, we're able to see them and do some analysis and see what he's talking to voters about. We worked with a developer to build a database that kind of took the ad archive and scrape everything that we could get out of there for all of the ads that Trump ran in 2019. And then from that, we were able to look and kind of do some analysis to say, well, what issues is he talking about? What's the tone here? What are the kind of messages that he's bringing to people?
And what kind of topics are these ads focusing on? Are there the same themes coming up again and again?
Yes. Trump's signature issue since he launched his campaign has been immigration.
And he'll stop illegal immigration by building a wall on our southern border that Mexico will pay for.
We're going to build the wall. We have no choice. We have no choice.
And he's been pushing, you know, building a border wall on the southern border, demonizing and being very negative about immigrants. And that is absolutely one of the top issues that comes up in the ads based on kind of a keyword analysis that I did of this whole database. One thing that I was surprised by, though, was that even above immigration, the number one topic that comes up was just being negative about the news media. That is really, you know, in one out of every five ads, that is part of the message that he is using.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake.
Tonight, the media is lying to you, and we have evidence.
Phony, fake.
You wouldn't know it from watching the news. America is winning.
While there are, you know, a lot of these angry messages about immigration, media, impeachment, etc., a huge swath of them are actually practically non-political, but are clearly kind of tuned to get the supporters that see them to click on a link and enter their email address or their mobile phone number. And they're going to use that data later on the line. And they use a ton of kind of the type of language that makes people feel a sense of urgency. Hurry, 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 there's a deadline coming. If you sign up now, like, you'll be entered twice in a rally.
Add your name to my list of supporters before 9 p.m. tonight.
They do a huge number of ads that are just signing a kind of a holiday card for members of the Trump campaign. Donald Trump and Melania Trump are not going to sit down and look at a list of people that signed their birthday card.
And that is why I need every Trump supporter to pick up the phone right now and deliver a personal thank you to your president.
But it is a very effective way to get somebody to give you their email address. So once they have your email address, they don't have to rely on Facebook to get in touch with you anymore. Now they can also just go around Facebook and email you directly, or if you give up your phone number, text you directly.
From the adverts that you've watched, how have they targeted the Democrats?
You see Trump's political opponents are mentioned all of the time in these ads. You know, the number one person that is a target is Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. And she just comes up over and over and over again.
Betrayal of our national security and betrayal of the integrity of our elections.
Interestingly, Elizabeth Warren was the candidate that he kind of went after the most.
Over and over, thinking somehow he's going to shut me up.
So the theme here seems to be women.
Yes, I think that's very much. And, you know, and the language is really quite shocking often.
You mentioned Nancy Pelosi, and I imagine that a lot of vitriol was directed towards her because of the impeachment process. How did Trump's Facebook ads respond to that inquiry?
When you read and watch these ads, you understand that there's a very deliberate effort being made to draw out feelings of resentment and kind of unjust persecution. And there's often, often this kind of appeal to the idea that both you, the viewer of this ad, and Trump are being treated unfairly. And if you just come together, you can fight back against that. And you can see how the impeachment has kind of played into that. He uses the language of unjust persecution, of witch hunt. This is a scam. They're lying about me. And then he turns it and he makes it about the individual. And he says they're doing this because they don't want you to get to decide the future of this country. They want to take away your vote. I think the impeachment really, he used that really kind of very explicitly to make his impeachment and to try to make it into an attack on his supporters.
It was corrupt. It was dirty cops. It was leakers and liars. And this should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I can see how it would be effective. You know, when you read these ads and you kind of try to put yourself into that emotional space, I can see how that would work.
Let's talk about the Democratic candidates. How are they using Facebook in this election campaign?
The Democratic candidates on Facebook, for the most part, are still using Facebook ads in kind of the traditional Democratic campaigning manner.
I'm not afraid to stand up to billionaires and corrupt politicians. I've been doing it for years.
Real change never takes place from the top on down, but always from the bottom on up.
They're much more traditional. They're often kind of persuasion-based. You just don't see the kind of negativity in those ads that you see from the Trump campaign.
Folks, America's an idea that's stronger than any army, bigger than any ocean, more powerful than any dictator.
And then,
of course,
you do also see some of the same kind of list-building techniques. And that is definitely something that the Democratic candidates are learning from. They are also running contests. Yesterday, I was looking at Pete Buttigieg's campaign, and he's running a contest to have pizza with Pete.
Hey, everyone. We're in South Bend. I'm at one of my favorite places, enjoying some pizza, as you can see. Of
course, so enter your email, and they will draw somebody, and somebody will get to have a slice of pizza with Pete Buttigieg.
Wow. Just one slice of pizza.
Well, I mean, maybe they might have a whole pie.
To be automatically entered, and I hope I'll see you here in South Bend.
But are they spending as much as Trump is on these adverts?
So there has been a major development in the Democratic field just in the recent months, which is that in late November, Mike Bloomberg jumped into the race.
The battle of the billionaires is on. Michael Bloomberg officially jumping into the 2020 race.
And he's a billionaire businessman, built a huge company, went into politics, and was elected mayor of New York. And he is spending outrageous amounts of money. I believe that he is now personally outspending the Trump campaign on Facebook.
And what's his Facebook campaign like compared to Trump's?
He appears to be running an almost Trumpian Facebook campaign, although it's very much anti-Trump.
A White House beset by lies, chaos, and corruption. An administration that has failed the American people.
He also, like Trump, is launching thousands of different ads a day. And they're very emotive and meme-like.
Mike Bloomberg will get it done.
The Trump campaign actually ran a small set of ads that used images of what I would describe as cute and imperiled animals to try to get people to click. So these were ads, you know, they showed an adorably cute puppy, but it was somewhat dark and he looked a little bit cold and he was maybe behind a chain link fence. And it said, Donald Trump is fighting against cruelty to animals. The Bloomberg campaign is running practically the same ads. They also have adorable pictures of puppies and cats, and they say Mike saves animals.
How How does Facebook regulate political advertising on its platform?
Facebook does not regulate political advertising on its platform, in a nutshell. There are certain rules that they apply to all advertisers. But one of the very controversial things that Facebook did last year was that they announced that one of the rules that they have for regular advertisers, you know, advertisers that are selling sneakers or, advertising a small business, is that they're not allowed to be misleading. They're not allowed to lie. Last fall, Nick Clegg, former deputy prime minister who now works for Facebook, gave a speech and revealed that they had decided to exempt politicians from that rule. And they're basically saying, we're not going to enforce that. We're not going to prevent politicians from lying in their ads. Not only that, but they also, Facebook does have a third-party fact-checking program. They said that they are exempting all ads from that process.
We do not submit speech by politicians to our independent fact-checkers, and we generally allow it on the platform, even when it would otherwise breach our normal content rules.
What was their reason and justification for doing that?
Their justification is that they think that the people should be able to see what politicians are saying. That if a politician wants to lie in an ad, that that's useful information for voters to have. And so then it is up to the press to then publicize and inform the citizens that the politician is lying. And I think that a lot of people think that their actual reason is A, that they don't want to get into a fight with the Trump campaign. And B, it would be almost impossible. The scale of the ads that are going up, to have fact checkers checking every single one before it goes up, that would require thousands and thousands and thousands of more people working for Facebook to do that work.
So Facebook has made it easier for political parties to put whatever they want up on the platform, and they're still making it difficult for us to find out how that works. Is this simply because it makes them a lot more money?
I think probably that one of the reasons that Facebook's not doing it is because it would actually be very difficult for them to make the call between what is a political ad and what isn't. And that would almost require as many staff as it would require to fact check them. The other thing is that I also just think that Facebook believes in its own propaganda. I think that Mark Zuckerberg thinks that his products are good.
And, you know, people no longer have to rely on traditional gatekeepers in politics or media to make their voices heard. And that has important consequences.
And I think that that is probably a misconception on his part, but that is a very core belief of his, that Facebook is good for the world.
But I actually believe that the much bigger story is how much these platforms have decentralized power by putting it directly into people's hands. It's part of this amazing expansion of voice that we've experienced through law and culture and now technology as well.
Having spent a year watching Facebook adverts from the Trump campaign, how do you think that this might play out in the election?
He is going to start focusing more and more on his Democratic candidates, you know, as that field narrows. Currently, as we speak, he's in some kind of Twitter war with Mike Bloomberg. He's going to start getting very, very personal about the candidates as well.
Every day between now and November 2020, we are going to keep on working. We are going to keep on fighting.
More of the same, really, Julia.
Definitely more of the same. And I think that one of the things with the Trump campaign in general is that I keep thinking that I've lost my ability to be shocked, and then I get shocked again.
We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. Thank you.
Julia, keep up the good work. Thank you for speaking to me.
Thank you so much.
You can read Julia Carey Wong's investigation at theguardian.com. And turning to a political race closer to home, On Tuesday, the 25th of February, Anushka is hosting a Labour leadership hustings in Manchester. Tickets are still available and you can buy them on the website. Coming up, Leia Green on the death of Caroline Flack. Now, there's been an outpouring of tributes after Caroline Flack, the former Love Island presenter, died on Saturday. She had recently been under intense scrutiny after her arrest for an alleged assault against her boyfriend and was due to stand trial next month. Guardian journalist Leia Green reflects on the impact the news of her death has had on her.
Do you really know somebody if you follow them on social media? I've been quite surprised at how hard Caroline Flack's death hit. Obviously, it doesn't compare to the grief that her friends and family will be feeling, but it did actually stop me in my tracks. For fans of Love Island, like me, and especially those of us who use social media, Caroline Flack has kind of seeped into our lives over the last 5 years. She was in our living rooms every summer and on our phones almost every day. We've watched her on nights out, eating lunch, singing at a piano, and after following her for a while, you start to develop opinions about her clothes, about her presenting styles, about her love life. They were all private opinions, but you kind of felt like you were in a one-sided relationship with this person from the TV. In a time where we want famous people to seem authentic, it was actually her vulnerabilities, in particular in her romantic life, that made her so relatable and gave people so much more to talk about. And then she died, and it felt really different from other celebrity deaths. With people like David Bowie, you did know them in a sense through their music, but you didn't know what they did with their friends at the weekend. You might have watched Robin Williams' films, but you still didn't know the person behind the characters he played. With Caroline, you were being lulled deeper and deeper into this relationship with her through social media. And for many people, it's been painful and quite confusing to try and reconcile the happy Caroline that we got so used to with this tragedy. So what's left in her absence is all the stuff people are saying about her. There are heartfelt tributes from those who knew her, and then you have a newspaper deleting a negative article it had written about her just the day before her death. The press had an absolute field day with her fall from grace. They trawled through all the details of her life for story after story. But honestly, as somebody who follows her, I probably would have ended up reading some of those stories. But no matter how enticing that gossip may be, I just really think that we need to stop incentivising the tabloid press to treat anyone in the public eye as fair game. Social media has allowed celebrities to invite us into certain parts of their lives, and we've taken that as an invitation into all of the parts of their lives. Perhaps we need to redraw some boundaries and stop feeling like we have ownership over people just because we follow them online.
That was Leia Green. If you've been affected by any of the issues Leia raised, Samaritans can be contacted in the UK on 116 123 or jo at samaritans.org. Other international helplines can be found at befrienders.org. Thanks to Leia and Julia Carey Wong. Today's episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Gacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.